So you've been in therapy for years. Maybe you've been in 12-step recovery for years. You've read the books, you know your attachment style, you understand your trauma, and yet you're still waiting to actually feel different. You're still stuck in the same patterns you've been stuck in for a really, really long time. And listen, if I am describing you here, no shame at all, because for a very, very long time, this was me. And then I realized that all of my healing had been from the neck up. I had never actually gotten into my body, and I learned that somatic healing, nervous system regulation, it's not optional. Like, it's not just a suggestion. It is a requirement if you actually want to heal from a dysfunctional childhood. And what do you know? Once I actually started doing that work, I finally started making headway on the patterns that I was starting to think that I was going to be stuck in for the rest of my life. And so I built a course, y'all. It is called Safe Within, and it is everything that has actually worked for me all in one 7-week life journey. It's 3 parts. In the first part, we are going to actually learn how to feel safe in our bodies through practices rooted in somatic experience. Experiencing and polyvagal theory. Then in part 2, through somatic parts work, we are going to get to know the parts of us that are keeping us stuck in places that we don't want to be stuck in. And then in part 3, this is about actually learning how to feel good as a felt experience in your body. Because let's be honest, for so many of us, good feelings are deeply uncomfortable. Calm feels unsafe, joy feels suspicious, and we're going to do something about that, okay? And here's something I want to be really honest about. One of the biggest reasons I struggle to do this work for so long is that I could not get myself to do it alone. Like every day I would tell myself, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And then what do you know, at the end of the day, I had not done X, Y, and Z. This was day after day after day, year after year after year. And so part of what I built into this intentionally is the accountability piece. We meet live, you show up. You can't just talk yourself out of it the way that you can when you're trying to do this stuff on your own. And listen, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that you're going to be perfectly healed after 7 weeks, but what I do think is that you are going to feel a hell of a lot more connected to your body. You are going to feel much safer actually being in your body, and you're going to walk away with tools that you will use for years, if not for the rest of your damn life. And I want to make this very, very clear. You do not need to have any prior experience with IFS, with parts work, somatic work to do this course. None. You can show up having never heard of any of these words before, and you will be taken care of. I will guide you through every single step. So we start July 1st. When you sign up, you also get 2 months free in the shit show with access to all of our weekly support groups and everything else that we got going on in there. So you, yes, you, yes, you, the person who knows that they need to sign up, the person who is currently in their head right now, thinking about how I need to do this course, get out of your damn head and get into your damn body. Take that little hand of yours, get on your computer or on your phone, and just sign the hell up already. Go to adultchildpodcast.com/safewithin, adultchildpodcast.com/safewithin. And if you have any questions at all, feel free to email me directly at Andrea@adultchildpodcast.com. Do it. Do it now. No one is entitled to the peace of mind you fought so hard to build, not even the people who raised you. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shitshows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shitshow. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family. I'm a recovering alcoholic myself, 17 years sober. And this is the podcast where we talk about what the hell to do when you realize that your childhood screwed you up more than you initially thought, which I had this realization myself after dating 2 alcoholics named Brian back to back. You can listen to my very first episode if you want to hear that story. I promise you'll be entertained, and have been on this childhood trauma healing journey for the past 8 years. Still in it, baby. Still healing. So welcome aboard this hot mess of a ship. We curse here. You've been warned. Real quick, folks. Safe Within starts 2 weeks from today. We kick off on July 1st. Get your damn spot. There's not a ton left. Okay, do it now. So today we are diving deep with Lisa Stinson. She is a therapist and she is the author of the newly published book, The Obligation Myth: Rethinking What You Owe Your Difficult aging parent. Yes. Yes. This was actually a really interesting conversation for me. And I think that this is a really interesting and important topic for us to explore, like how we show up as our parents age, as they're confronted with illness or needing caregiving, and just all of the shit that that stirs up in us, which is a lot, folks. And how do we figure out what's the right decision for us? Because there is no one size fits all here. There is no right or wrong way here. This really is an individual decision. And I think that this conversation expands way beyond just our aging parents, because the question that is at the heart of this, like, what do we owe these people? I think that that question applies to essentially every relationship in our lives, right? Like, what do we owe the people that hurt us? What do we owe the people in our lives in general? What is actually ours to carry? And what is unnecessary guilt and obligation that stems from what we endured in our childhoods? So I think that this conversation is really useful to any of us, regardless of whether your parents are still alive, regardless of whether you're estranged from your parents or not, whatever the hell your situation is, because this really does come back to the relationship that we have with ourselves. So let's get on with the damn show, shall we? But first, let's talk about what you, yes, you need to damn the join shit show, my online support community, where we have a minimum of 6 weekly Zoom support groups. You can find the schedule to our groups on my website at adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow, where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. We really are doing the work here, folks. Okay, we're doing it. We're healing. We're getting vulnerable. We're getting raw. We're getting real. We're showing up as our messy selves. And we're also having some fun and laughing along the way, too. So you, yes, you, the person who feels that little pit in their stomach right now, the person that's been wanting to join for forever, how about you just do it already? Let's just do it today for less than a damn dollar a day. You can quit after a month if you don't like it. Go to the link in the show notes or go to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow next. Oh, really quickly, I want to say, too, I've been including in the show notes for the past, I don't know how many episodes I've been doing it, maybe the past 10 to 20 episodes. I've included links to, like, if you like this episode, you might like these episodes. I have a million bajillion episodes. There's some suggestions in the show notes that you might want to check out. You also can find a link to my Substack, to my newsletter in the show notes as well. Give the gal a follow on Insta, on TikTok, at AdultChildPod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. It really does help me reach more people. Thank you. Love you all. Here is where I always like to start, Lisa. When was the moment that you realized that your childhood screwed you up more than you thought?
Oh, God. We just get right into it.
Yeah, this is how we roll. This is how we roll here.
There were a couple of different times. The first one, I was in graduate school, actually. And so I'm like in my 30s.
Were you studying psychology?
I was. And so I ended up actually finishing my bachelor's degree a little later. Was in the military for a few years, got my undergraduate done while I was active duty. And then I got out, went to grad school. And I remember it was my third year of grad school. And we're doing kind of a group supervision sort of situation. And we do kind of case conceptualization and, you know, treatment recommendations kind of as a group with our supervisor. And one of the students that was there with me was talking about a patient and describing this situation. And everyone else in the room was completely mortified by how abusive this this story sounded to them. And I'm listening to it and I'm thinking, why is everybody getting so upset? This isn't that bad. And it's like, what is it about me that makes me think that this wasn't that bad? And that was really kind of the first time that I went, okay, something's off here. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's kind of your abnormal normal and you don't really know any different until you see it in a different kind of way or it's pointed out. And it's like, well, wait a minute. I thought that everybody's family was like this. I knew that my mother was hateful and that I was scapegoated. Mm-hmm. Of course, I didn't know the language. What 8-year-old knows the language. But I knew that I wasn't happy growing up. I knew I was going to leave the first chance I got, but I really didn't wrap my head around just how bad it was until sitting in that group supervision that day, and everybody was having such a strong reaction to something that I'm like, are you kidding? That's like a random Tuesday. What are you talking about? This is so horrible that things really kind of shifted. So I would say, you know, and I was probably like 33, 34 years old at the time.
Yeah, it's like the classic meme of when you're nonchalantly, you know, telling the stories of your childhood and everyone else is just like completely horrified.
Right. And now, you know, when I was in clinical practice and I would be with a patient and, you know, ask them about any history of child abuse in the intake. Oh, no, nothing like that. You know, and then they'd start describing all different types of abuse. And it's like, well, would you do these things to your own children? It's like, oh my God, no. Well, why not? And it's like, well, of course I'd never do that to my children. That's horrible. It's like, but when it happened to you, you don't see it as abusive. And I see that with my own patients in clinical practice all the time, where it's just kind of, it's not till you really are kind of put on the spot about it that you kind of have that aha moment about what you really did go through growing up.
And then was there a moment for you where you had an aha of seeing the way in which it was impacting your life as an adult?
Well, once you see it, then you can't unsee it.
Yeah.
Right. And so then you start noticing it all over the place. And it's like, oh my goodness, you know, this was a really unhealthy relationship, or, you know, I understand now why I handled this situation in that way. Then you start connecting the dots. Once you see it again, you can kind of recognize that, you know, you recognize that in your own behavior, you can recognize it in the behavior of others, you know? So it's like, okay, now when you can identify that, yes, I was the family scapegoat, you can see those relationships and unpackage that and really see the dynamics between you and your siblings, or you and your, you know, the toxic parent, the enabling parent, the flying monkeys that were in your life. And you can kind of break that down and see it more clearly once you kind of understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. When these lights started to come on for you, were you still like actively in relation with your family, or like actively being scapegoated?
Well, you never stop being scapegoated.
Well, yeah, that's true, but you know.
Basically when I was 17 and left home, that was kind of, I really didn't have a lot of contact with my family. And I go for periods of years and years and years with no contact at all with my mother. My dad, I tried a little, you know, off and on over the years, but it's just kind of like, okay, I'm leaving now. And it was nice knowing you.
Yeah. Thanks for the place to sleep.
Right. Right.
I was an only child. I was put in the role of the identified patient, and then I leaned into the scapegoat role from there. Like, so I developed separation anxiety, and there was alcoholism in the home that wasn't being addressed. And everyone was aware that there was alcoholism in the home that wasn't being addressed. And so I got sent to a therapist, and of course they didn't tell the therapist what was actually going on. And then it was like, from there, I then sort of leaned into that shame and then started acting out, and then was more of a traditional type scapegoat role. But I guess the one benefit of being the scapegoat is that we tend to find healing a lot sooner than especially the golden child ever would. You know, it's like our pain is greater, so we have like more of a chance of being forced into healing out of necessity.
Well, and we see that we're more apt to see the situation for what it really was.
Yep.
You'll find the, like the golden child, for example, or the enmeshed child, who kind of puts a positive spin on things, and, oh, it wasn't really that bad. And, you know, you need to stop being so hard on mom, and, or what have you. Whereas the scapegoat is the one who's really going to see things much more clearly because those loyalties aren't really there. You've already been shamed and blamed and criticized and manipulated and told that how worthless you are through years of your life, that it's like, well, I don't really owe this family much. And so to kind of take that step back and have a more realistic look at things, I think is easier for the scapegoat to do. And by extension, it's easier to kind of take that step away from the family, whether you're going, minimal contact or you decide to go no contact with the family. It's much easier to do when you're the scapegoat.
Yeah, 100%. How many siblings did you have?
Two.
Two. And where did you fall in the line?
I was the oldest.
Okay.
My sister was the invisible child. She was the middle. My brother was the golden child, and he was the youngest.
It's interesting. You tend to think of the golden child or the hero child being the oldest, but I guess it's just as common for the oldest to be the scapegoat. So your mother was, I'm assuming your mother was, would you classify her as being a true narcissist or like having narcissist tendencies?
Oh no, full on DSM 5 diagnosed. Yes, 100%. And then my father enabled the behavior. And I think, in part of why our roles shook out the way that they did, if I had been a boy and the oldest, I think it would have been different. But my brother was going to be the golden child. He was going to take over the family business, and he was, going to be the football star and going to, so all of that positive projection happened to my brother. On the other hand, if he decided not to go into the family business, that golden child role might have
Would have been
changed for
stripped from him. He would
him.
have slotted into the scapegoat. What do you know about your mom's upbringing?
Not a lot. It sounds like she had a similar relationship to her mother that she had to me. That her mother was very much selfish, self-involved, overly critical. From what I gathered from my dad, the two of them never got along. I mean, superficially they got along, but they'd also have regular falling outs as well. Her sister was very much the peacemaker of the family, brothers, golden children, particularly the youngest. So it was similar in that sort of way, but she and I have never had a conversation about it.
Interesting. So I don't know if there are any other books that are specifically written about this. Have you come across any that are targeted just on this?
I have not. Of course, there are plenty of books out there on the narcissistic family system, and there are a few books out there on caregiving, but I haven't found anything that really intersected the two, and so that's why I wrote this. Maybe in part because you get to a certain age and you're in that sandwich. You get to be in your 40s, 50s, 60s, and there's kind of an expectation for women that it's your job to take care of aging family members, in addition to taking care of your teenage kids, you've got kids in
Everything
college, you
else,
might be
everything else.
raising grandkids, have a job, spouse, you might even be providing caregiving for your spouse's parents. And you kind of get to that stage of life, particularly as women, that people kind of expect you to step in and perform that role.
Yeah, and I think that this conversation, this topic is applicable to any sort of dysfunctional family system. So, yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask you was like what was sort of the motivation behind it? I mean, it sounds like, your own personal feelings, but also were you seeing this a lot in clients?
Seeing it in a lot of my clientele, we tend to think of this of the caregiving relationship in sort of this happy, loving, family where, of course, you would take care of each other because you love each other and you have this very healthy, wonderful relationship. But that's not who I'm talking to. And so, I'm thinking about the child who was beaten black and blue by their father, whipped with a belt, kicked with leather boots on, just battered and bloody. What does that child owe their aging parent now? Or the little girl who grew up being criticized and devalued by her mother and, her mother who was cruel for sport and loved nothing more than to diminish that little girl. What does that child now owe the parent? Or if you had a father, stepfather, grandfather who sexually abused you, and now that person needs help with bathing, toileting, dressing, which is going to be immensely triggering. What do you owe that person? So I'm taking the conversation out of the loving, healthy, of course you would provide care for your parents sort of family system, and looking at these families. And what do you owe?
So those were all like pretty extreme versions. Is this still a relevant question for somebody who experienced just as much complex trauma? But if it's more subtle forms of emotional and psychological abuse and neglect, is the question still the same? Because I think that what you just described, it's easier for those people to say, like, I don't know them shit. I think it's more so for people who, maybe it seems it's less obvious. That's kind of where it gets complicated.
It is. And there really isn't a one size fits all sort of answer to this because, abuse, it's not an all or nothing sort of situation. It happens on a Likert scale. It might have been an 80 for you and a 20 for someone else. It might have been an 80 for you and a 20 for someone else in the same family, depending on what your childhood role was. And so, depending on the type of abuse, the level of abuse, the severity of that abuse, how that has impacted you through the course of your life are all going to factor in when it comes to what do you owe your difficult aging parent? And that said, it's not just that difficult, narcissistic, toxic parent. What about that enabling parent who maybe wasn't outright abusive, but did nothing to protect you from the abuser, who knew about the abuse, was completely aware, but did nothing to stop it, aligned with the narcissist, with the toxic person, wanted to avoid the conflict and was willing to, allow their 10-year-old to take it. What do you owe that person?
Yeah, and it's also too like there's no right or wrong answer, right? I think the other thing that factors into it as well is where is somebody in their own healing journey too?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because one person, who's farther along in their healing journey, and again, depending on so many other factors, might be able to set those necessary boundaries and still maintain a relationship, as opposed to someone else who just has to go no contact, because that's what their own mental health requires.
Yeah, and I think also too, such a large part of healing, especially in the beginning, but I think that this continues on as you peel back deeper layers of the onion. But so much of it, at least initially, is feeling all those feelings that you never felt as a kid that you had the right to feel, like being really, really, really pissed off. But I think that this is what I'll say for myself. So both of my parents, like, still I mean, they're not drinking right now, but, you know, I would still say untreated alcoholism. So there's times when, like right now I'm in an okay space with them, like, but I have a lot of distance, you know, and I've established a lot of boundaries.
Right.
And for the most part, like, I can now be in a space where I can have compassion for them. Like, I'm able to see that they're sick and suffering. But then when new stuff comes up, if I have like a new, you know, revelation or, and that's not to say I had stages where I was super fucking pissed off. There's been times when I've had to cut contact with them completely. But then when there's new stuff that comes up, like that compassion, that sort of acceptance for who they are, that goes out the window, you know? And so it's sort of this vacillating between those two sorts of feelings. But it took me a long time before I was able to kind of get to this place of like, you know, acceptance and compassion for them. And that's not to say that everybody's going to get to that spot, but that took me a long time to get there, you know?
Right, right. Well, and that's the thing. The nature of the relationship and what you provide in terms of that caregiving, you know, it can change from, you know, from today to 6 months from now. One thing that we know about the family dynamic is as these parents get older, first of all, the narcissist, their behavior doesn't improve with age, right? They tend to get worse even.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done the work, you've maybe taken some time away from the family or setting those boundaries, and you've worked with a therapist, you might have tried meds, you know, you're reading all the books, doing all the things. It's like, okay, I'm in a really good, healthy place. You know, I've got a good relationship with my kids. Everything seems to be in a good place. But there's something about elder care and that situation mm-hmm. that pulls people back into those old family roles. And so it's like, oh, I've been doing really good work for decades, but now I'm being pulled back into the role of scapegoat.
Yep.
And if I don't do these things for my difficult aging parent, I am the selfish, worthless person she always said that
mm-hmm.
I was.
Mm-hmm.
And so of course that's going to be triggering. And you think, oh, I've worked through all this. I'm really good. But then it's like, you know what? I need to kind of reevaluate my boundaries or take that step away again, just to kind of reevaluate, because I know that I'm getting triggered here. If you've done enough work to recognize I'm getting triggered here and this is the reason why.
So I'm curious, because so much of this really has to be focused on the individual, right? Like what it's really bringing up in them, like what it is that they're experiencing. When you're working with somebody and kind of helping them to unpack this stuff, what have you found are questions or things for them to consider? Because I think so often it's like we're just so focused, the little kid in us or the part of us like feels so guilty and who's been parentified and is so used to putting the needs and the feelings of other people above their own. What have you found helps to shift people to reflect on how they're being impacted by the situation?
Well, I think what I have found is really kind of identifying what role you played in the family, because your role is going to kind of determine a lot of the rest of it. So let's take that scapegoat. So the scapegoat is like, well, you know, screw this. I don't owe this person anything. After the way I was treated, after the way I was abused, neglected, blamed, shamed, I don't owe this person anything. And so, you know, that can be a real part of it. But then there's that old childhood part.
Mm-hmm.
Says, well, you're as bad as she always said you were if you don't help out. And so that's kind of the struggle for that particular person. Do I do the thing that feels right, or do I lapse back into this old role here? What's going to be triggering for that person? Being accused, mm-hmm. being blamed, being shamed, being attacked, being criticized. All of those things that difficult parent used to do, that's going to come flooding back again if it stopped in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so those are going to be the triggers for that adult child in that caregiving relationship. And so boundary setting for that person is going to be more difficult when those issues, those old issues of shame, blame, not being good enough, come back into the fold. That is different from, say, the invisible child in the family who made it through the toxic family environment by blending into the woodwork. Mm-hmm. If they don't see me, they can't hurt me. And so what happens with the invisible child is in that kind of caregiving situation is, well, she won't mind. She can change her schedule. She doesn't mind coming, giving up her weekend, and she's not going to say anything about it because that's her role. And the dysfunctional family system is counting on her not to say anything about it. And so she takes it on and takes it on and takes it on. And she's probably taking it on from her own kids, spouse, job. She's got all this stuff going on in her life. But there's that, I don't want to be a burden. I don't want to be a trouble. I'm just going to keep my head down and do the thing. And nobody says thank you. No one acknowledges the work that she's done. Family decisions are made without her input, and she's just expected to roll with it. Again, the family is counting on that. Mm-hmm. And so then for that person to set a boundary is going to be different in an entirely different sort of way. You know, standing up for oneself is something that got you attacked in the family, got you called out. So it's easier just to keep your head down and keep moving. And so that's going to be different from, say, the golden child, who has probably been promised a much larger piece of the inheritance.
Yeah.
Which is another factor that's in play here. Because you can't always just go no contact because there could be a sizable estate involved. Hate to say it, but that is the reality of the situation. And so if that golden child is under the impression that they're getting 80% of the estate, how do they need to manage their behavior and not upset the difficult parent to ensure that they're getting their larger share of the inheritance down the road? And that's another thing that the toxic narcissistic parent will do is play siblings off of each other. Yeah. Well, I'm just gonna, if you can't be there for me, then I'm just going to write you out of the will. Or if you do this for me, I'm going to ensure that you receive a larger share. And so you have all of these different things in play, depending on what role you played in the family. And it's going to determine kind of how you navigate those dynamics.
So generally speaking, I'll just like use the scapegoat, for example, you have these two kind of conflicting parts that you're dealing with, right? You have the part that's like, screw them, I don't owe them anything. And if I don't help out, like I'm everything that they said that I was. I would also think that for certain people, there's a third part that would almost be like a moral judgment. Like, is that also like come into play? Do you see that happen as well?
Yeah. And that, so moral judgment, are you talking about something that's implanted or something coming from the person's authentic self?
I would say either. That's a great point.
So if it's coming from the individual's authentic self, mm-hmm. then this is someone who's done quite a bit of work, right? They're able to see the situation for what it is, see all the relational dynamics playing out, and taking that step back to say, okay, caregiving for my difficult aging parent is less about what they think I owe, what society thinks I owe, what the flying monkeys in my life think I owe, what the church thinks I owe, what the social worker at the hospital thinks that I owe, right? This is it really coming down to, this is what I feel I can live with. Mm-hmm. Not only in the here and now, what I'm going to decide for myself, what's reasonable, but also what can I live with after they're gone? So when they're long gone, years down the road, can I look at the situation and say, you know what, I was estranged from my parent, or I stepped in twice a month and took them to appointments or went to Sunday dinner, whatever the situation might have been. And it's something that I can really be okay with. And for some people, despite all of the years of childhood abuse and abuse, you know, probably continuing on into their adult relationship with their parent, is to maintain a level of consistent caregiving. And so how do you navigate that then? Knowing where your boundary struggles are, you know, depending on that old childhood role, right? And you can, we know, you know, we, let's say you go into the hospital and you have your gallbladder removed. The nurses don't come home with you. The surgeon doesn't come home with you. They provide very competent caregiving while you're in the hospital, but there isn't the emotional attachment to it, right? They're going to do everything they can for you during your hospital stay, and they're going to take good care of you, but there doesn't necessarily have to be an intimate relationship.
Yeah, there's not an emotional charge.
Exactly. To where you can, you know, kind of gray rock the situation. If mm-hmm. if you feel that caregiving is something that you need to do, okay, mm-hmm. how do you do it that's going to be the least triggering for you? And again, that's going to be, you know, up to the individual as well. And so that might be, you know what? Sorry, Mom, we've got a full house. You cannot move in with us, but I am more than happy to work with the social worker, talk to Medicare, and figure out how we can get you in home health care and make that happen. And I will help you pay for it. But we don't have you cannot move in with us. So you're providing the competent caregiving. You're making sure that their physical needs are taken care of, but you don't necessarily have to sacrifice yourself to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have so many thoughts running in my head. This is great. Did your brother take over the business?
He did.
Are both of your parents still alive?
They are.
And do both of your siblings still live where your parents live?
So my parents divorced right after I graduated high school. So they haven't been together for decades. So my brother, he runs the family business, and you know, it's all as you would expect it to be, right? But my sister died a few years ago. But just to kind of give you a sense of what the family dynamic was like. So my sister had, she had been renting a house from our mother, who inherited quite a bit of money and had a couple of houses, rental properties, from her parents. And so my sister was renting a house from her, paying, you know, X amount, you know, a reasonable amount of rent, running her business out of her house. But in the later stages of her cancer, was so ill that she couldn't keep working. And so she was in the hospital. It was before the brain meds had set in. So she was still somewhat lucid. And she's dying. She died 4 days after this conversation. But my mother was complaining to everyone at the hospital because my sister had not paid her rent for the last 2 months. So her daughter's in the hospital dying, and she's complaining that she didn't get her rent. And this is a person who is financially fine. So what do you owe a person like that?
When you left the picture, did she kind of fill that scapegoat role?
She did. And this was, and this is the interesting thing about the dysfunctional family system, mm-hmm. is that the system wants to maintain homeostasis. And so when I left and my sister fell into the family scapegoat role, my sister was angry with me, mm-hmm. because being the family scapegoat was my job,
yeah,
in the family.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't, well, let's hold Mom accountable. Mm-hmm. It's your fault because you left. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that in the narcissistic family, in that kind of dysfunctional family system, when you've got a narcissist in play.
So then your brother, has he maintained a relationship with both your mom and your dad?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And how is your parents' health?
I have no idea.
So do you feel like in this sort of situation where you have a sibling who is present, lives around your parents, does that make, I'm not saying for you specifically, but just like in general, does that make this sort of like an easier experience for some people when there is another sibling who is present and in good company with the family?
I think that's going to be a case by case basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's almost like two things. I'm sure there's a lot more than two, but sort of like two things that somebody might be battling with. One is just sort of this false responsibility of it's just my job to be there while my parents are aging and, you know, nearing death, kind of like a presence thing. But then it can become a different sort of predicament when then like a lack of care is part of the picture. You know what I mean? Like there could be like a situation where a parent is taken care of, right? They have the resources, or there's the other siblings, and a child might still wrestle with that guilt and responsibility that I should be present because my parent is dying. That's one thing, but then somebody else might not deal with that or struggle with that. But then when they're, let's just say like there isn't anybody else, like there isn't any care, then that throws in another wrench in there.
Right. And in that case, you know, do you have the flying monkeys, you know, the siblings of that parent or cousins, if you have, you know, stepping in to tell you what you should be doing, mm-hmm. or, you know, community members telling you what you should be doing. And ultimately it comes down to, you know, where you are in your healing journey, what that relationship was like and has continued to be like with your difficult parent, how severe the abuse was. And at the end of the day, you know, rather than what am I obligated to provide, it's like, what can I reasonably provide given all of those variables? What is it that's actually going to work for me? Mm-hmm. And that might mean you go back and be there for them and help them and, you know, move into their house or live down the road or help them get set up with the nursing home and make regular visits, whatever that's going to look like, is really an individual process. And that's basically what the book is all about. Mm-hmm. It's not a one, you know, there's not one answer to this question. And it's all about the individual figuring out what is going to work best for them. What works within my own set of values. Mm-hmm. What is the story that I can tell myself after they're gone? You know, can I be okay with that? Or is this something that I'm going to wrestle with? And if that's the case, do I need to modify this in some way? And again, you know, the decision you make about that now might be different a year from now.
Yeah, or tomorrow.
Or tomorrow. Absolutely. And so, you know, if the parent has maybe atoned for some of the things that they've done, apologized for the things that they put you through, acknowledged the wrongdoing, the abuse, the neglect, you know, if there were substance abuse issues and what that did, you know, any parentification you had to have, for example, growing up in that environment. If there is a genuine apology for that and an actual desire to make behavioral changes, is that going to shift something for you?
Mm-hmm.
Or you never get it.
And then I think the other part of it too is like having compassion for ourselves and like not shaming ourselves for whatever it is that we're choosing to do, you know, because it's a similar kind of situation, although it's not about like an aging parent, but Similar to a circumstance that you brought up earlier, somebody I know, her father sexually abused her as a kid. And she, in the past year, has been coming to terms with the role that her mom played. And I mean, it is really hard when you come to terms with like the safer parent that you realize the amount of damage that they inflicted on you. Like that's such a hard realization to come to.
Oh, it's a profound betrayal. Absolutely.
But she was very enmeshed with her mom. Like she's coming to terms with that. They were like, quote unquote, best friends. Like that's how she would have described it. And so it's really just been in the last year, she's 38, in the last year that she's really been coming to terms with her mom. But she still has parts of her, like she knows that she needs to go no contact, but there's still parts of her, you know, that are not ready to do that. And right. So it's about having compassion for herself. And I can really relate to this with my own parents of like, it took me a while to stop participating in the chaos and the dysfunction and to stop jumping in when it came to my mother's alcoholism. Like this is, you know, in adulthood, your nervous system is wired to do these things. It's all you know. And so right. It's really having the grace and compassion for yourself that even though you know you shouldn't, you need to be going no contact, it takes time for those parts of us to be in a place where we're able to do those things. And so oh, yeah. It's just like giving ourselves like the grace to be okay with where we're at.
Oh, absolutely. And I think you bring up something really important that doesn't get addressed enough. You know, we've kind of got the idea of, you know, no contact. It's kind of like the new thing, right? I mean, you go on Reddit and, oh, just go no contact. Oh, just like it's something that's done on a whim.
Yeah.
And that is simply not the case. It's years, mm-hmm. years of struggle, mm-hmm. Boundary violations and, you know, being gaslit and minimized and ignored.
Building enough a sense of self to where you're actually able to choose yourself, because yeah. That takes a lot of time. Like, it you know, before you can weigh more the way in which you're being impacted versus the way in which you think that you're impacting the other person.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And it, you're right. It takes a lot of self-reflection. It takes a lot of, you know, oftentimes therapy with someone else, getting the books, journaling, and really taking an uncomfortable look at, you know, how dysfunctional your family might have been, that this, you know, these things actually that were happening to you was your abnormal normal, but none of it was okay. And it can be really hard to just admit for the first time, oh my God, I was really abused by these people. I mean, that's heartbreaking for anyone to have to acknowledge that. And that's the starting point, mm-hmm. right? So yeah, the people say, oh no, you know, you see these parents groups, for example, and oh, you know, my kid's gone no contact.
Oh my God, I just had to block another one of them on Facebook yesterday. I'm like, okay, there's just like these people are just grifting off all these parents.
Yeah, and and it's like you have no idea that, you know, it took this woman 45 years to get to this point.
Yeah,
with after years of abuse and neglect and devaluing and criticism, you know, it wasn't a one-off.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that like maybe there is like some one-off experiences like where the kid is shitty, you know, but I would say generally right. speaking, like probably 90 to 95% of the time, it's not that, but I'm not going to like totally rule it out to where like, I'm sure there's some validity in someone somewhere, but most of them not.
But I want to hear their story.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Oh my God. It takes everything in me to not just like rip these people to shreds in the comments. So I just block them because it just makes me so angry.
Right. Right. They're starting to find me on my Substack as well. It's like, no. I'm sure there's a whole backstory that goes decades on why your adult daughter decided to limit her contact with you or set a boundary you don't like.
That you don't like. The other thing that I don't really hear being spoken about enough, though, about like the whole no contact thing is that I feel like the way that it gets discussed is like you eventually get to this place where you're making this decision to go no contact and you're making this decision for the rest of your life. Like you could, but like you don't have to make that decision. Like I feel like people feel like they have to get to a place where they're making a decision where they're going to go no contact with their family for the rest of their lives. And I think you could, but I think it's like just for the time being, you don't know what could happen. I mean, for me, I've had to go periods of time where I've cut my parents off, but then there's been times where like I'm able to have a relationship with them that works right now. It's very distant and there's lots of boundaries, but sometimes I feel like that's kind of how no contact is marketed, is like you're making a permanent decision and it doesn't need to be.
Right.
It can be.
But it doesn't have to. And you're right, a lot of people, you know, they've had periods of no contact with, you know, an adult parent or both parents, you know, off and on, you know, they might have gone no contact 5 or 6 times before they, you know, may or may not get to the one where, okay, that's it, never again, I'm not going to do this to myself again. But even when you go no contact and you know that is the right decision for you, you still have those moments where you remember something, something, a good time, or something funny happens as, oh, you know, my parent would love to hear about this. You know, ordinarily I would have picked up the phone and said, you know, told them this funny story. And even in that no contact space, you still will have those moments of, oh yeah, you know, there was this one, you know, family vacation we took, or this one time I, you know, had this piano recital, or what, you know, the football game, whatever the case might have been, that it's like, okay, yeah, there were these little glimpses of good times that might feel a little out of place in that, you know, no contact space. Yeah. It's like, okay, is no contact really the right, you kind of question yourself, right? Was this the right decision? Should I pull them back in? Should I not? For some people, maybe you do. For others, you don't necessarily have to.
Absolutely.
So it's not all or nothing.
It is not all or nothing. I would think the other thing that really comes up here is what can happen between siblings.
Well, again, you're all getting dragged back into those early roles.
Yeah.
Right? And so there are certain expectations that the siblings will have of each other. You know, that invisible child is expected to keep their head down and do the thankless work and not be included in the conversation. And if that invisible child were to try to stand up for themselves, like, hey, look, you know, I have a job, I have a presentation on Thursday, I can't take mom to her doctor's appointment, the siblings will, you know, fall back into their old roles of piling on. Well, you know, you're being selfish. What do you mean you can't? Come on. This is your job. You took this on. You know, the scapegoat. If they pull back from the caregiving, well, you're just, you know, you're selfish, just like dad says you are. You're everything that he said you were. Or there's an expectation for the golden child. Well, you know, you're their shining joy. You handle it all. You're getting the estate. So we're just going to leave you to it. So we do the work, we go to therapy, we read the books. And yet when we find ourselves back in that toxic family system, we roll right back into those old roles. And so part of it's being aware, it's like, okay, this shame is not mine. It's my sibling that's piling on me right now, has nothing to do with me. Where do I want to put it? How do I want to handle it? What boundary do I need to set with my sibling that they let them know they can't do that? And when they try to attack me further, how do I handle that? What boundary do I need to set? Do I need to walk away for a while?
I think also too, when you're going through this process, there's just a lot of grieving.
Grief is a big part of it. It's as your parent is aging, kind of facing their mortality, and after they're gone, there really is that kind of realization that you're never going to have the parent that you wished you would have had. They are never going to be that for you.
Yeah.
And you may know that years earlier. You know, this person does not have the capacity to be the loving parent that I needed them to be.
I still think that there's always, even if it's not that big, there's always a tiny, tiny bit that's hoping.
That's hoping. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so when you get there to the end, it's like, oh my God, this for real isn't going to happen. This person is never going to be this for me. And there is a tremendous amount of grief that comes with that. You know, that's part of that hopeful child. You know, we've got, so as part of that caregiving process, not only do we have our family role, but we have these different parts of ourselves that are in play, making these decisions for us.
Yep.
So we have the guilty child. You know, people are going to think I'm selfish if I don't step in and help. The hopeful child, if I do enough for my parent, maybe this time they'll finally see me. They'll finally love me. The angry protector, you know, well, I don't owe them shit, like you say. Or maybe this is my opportunity to exact revenge, right? And so you've got these different, and the inheritance seeker is part of that as well. So you've got all these different aspects of the self kind of at war with each other. So imagine, you know, they're in the car. You've got maybe the guilty one is driving the car. Maybe the angry mm-hmm. self is driving the car. You're locked in the trunk and they're running the show sometimes. And so part of doing the work, figuring out what's authentically going to be the best for you, is to take a seat at the table while honoring those different aspects of yourself. Mm-hmm. Because the guilty self, the angry self, the hopeful self, the wounded child, all of these different parts of yourself,
mm-hmm.
and they had a protective role for you. They kept you alive. They kept you going through all of it. And they legitimately deserve a seat at the table.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be honored and heard, but you need to be in the
leading.
Driver's seat.
Yeah, leading.
You need to be leading it. And so when it happens, say you tell your parent, oh, I can't take off work to drive you to your doctor's appointment. Well, I guess I shouldn't expect much from you. Mm-hmm. You've always been selfish, mm-hmm. right? And so immediately that guilty person, that wounded child, right? I'm as bad as she says I was, and if I just try a little harder, maybe I can take off work. And if I try a little harder, maybe then she'll see that I'm not as selfish as what she always told me I was, right? Mm-hmm. And so acknowledging all of that and then putting it to the side. So okay, my mother is manipulating me. This is part of her guilt tripping. This is what she does. I know that my wounded self, my guilty self, is under attack here. I know that that's what's being triggered. I know that's what's being activated. I understand that. Now I can set that boundary. Look, Mom, can't take you to your doctor's appointment. I have to, there's a meeting at work. I cannot miss. I'm giving the presentation. I will help you arrange a new. So acknowledging, honoring those parts of yourself.
And asking for some space.
And asking for some space.
Yes.
Making the choice from that authentic part of yourself that's now driving the car, instead of being hijacked by the angry protector, hijacked by the guilty self, hijacked by that wounded child, right?
But then also forgiving yourself and not beating the shit out of yourself. If you do get hijacked and you do make that decision, giving yourself some grace and compassion too.
Give right? yourself some grace. Right, right. Because it will happen.
Yes.
It absolutely will happen. It's like, okay, that's when you take that step back. It's like, okay, I see what I did. I see mm-hmm. what happened. This is how I could have handled mm-hmm. it. This is how I'm going to handle it differently when she does it the next time. And it's going to be imperfect. And that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That is 100% okay.
Okay, last area that I want to dive down, and then I'll ask you if there's anything we didn't discuss that you want to talk about. So two things. I think that one, a lot of people might have this like fantasy of their parent being on their deathbed and, you know, them having these sort of meaningful conversations. There's that, but then there's also two, somebody might feel like they do need to voice things to their parent, but it really needs to be coming from a place of, I'm saying this for me, not because I'm hoping to get a certain response. I'm going to be okay with me saying this regardless of how they respond. Have you had that come up much with clients and can sense that there's sort of an expectation there that is potentially dangerous or can be hurtful?
That's the key word right there. Expectation. Mm-hmm. You've got to manage your expectation in a situation like that. If you, after years of toxic abuse, criticism, never being good enough, ignored, feelings invalidated, gaslit, go to their deathbed expecting this big, movie moment, prepare yourself to be disappointed. Let me give you an example. It's actually an example from the book. So, there's a man raised by a very, very critical father. Nothing was ever good enough. The education wasn't good enough. The job wasn't good enough. Family wasn't, you didn't pick a good enough wife. Just critical across the board of his son. His son is now in his 50s. So his son sat down and wrote this very, poignant letter about, here, I forgive you for all of the years of abuse and criticism, and laid it all out for his father. Mm-hmm. I forgive you in this very kind of big way in this letter. A few days later, he gets a phone call from his father. "Well, son, I got your letter, but I have no idea what you're talking about. You were never abused. What do you mean? What are you forgiving me for? There's nothing to be forgiven for." And so he found himself then completely re-traumatized by the situation because his father had completely invalidated everything about the abuse, as well as this very, heartfelt letter of forgiveness. So a healthier way, and of course, this is going to depend on the parent, right? I mean, is this a person with full-blown narcissistic personality disorder? Is this someone with a few traits? Is this someone who was an enabling parent? What could they tolerate in terms of that conversation? Your malignant or covert narcissist will tolerate 0% of it. And that never happened. And what are you talking about? And I never did that. And that never happened to you. And you weren't abused, right? And you get nowhere with it. So it would be better to work that out with your therapist, through journaling, through, exercises, to kind of unpackage that for yourself, knowing that, your parent simply doesn't have the capacity to hear it and apologize for it and even acknowledge it, that you're going to be met with more of the same, depending on, the level of their toxicity and their psychopathology.
So do you have these feelings arise in you at all? As far as like the feeling, the guilt of being the oldest, being a female, you've obviously done a lot of work on yourself. You obviously are no contact with your family for the most part. Is there ever anything in you that gets stirred up?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's not what it once was, but healing is a process. It's, it's not like, okay, I'm all good now. Yeah. I'm done.
Shit. Sorry, folks.
Like, woohoo, right? But the thing is, you think you're doing really well, and it's like,
Lisa. I know that well.
And then all of a sudden you get hit with something out of the blue. It's like, oh my God, I did not see that coming. So, this is kind of back to, like you say, giving yourself a bit of grace
And
what is it that specifically comes up for you? Is it a guilt component or what? Or grief, or
I would say probably more grief.
Mm-hmm.
More grief. Just because doing what I do, I know what a healthy family can look like and be. And there's a real sadness in knowing that you're never going to have that.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though you may be doing a lot of the work, the other family members are not. But there's also, you know, the positive piece in knowing that you're kind of breaking those generational curses.
Yeah.
That this ends with me, even though I can grieve never getting to have, you know, that healthy, loving family that, you know, I really would have liked to have had. Little me especially would have liked to have had. But, you know, middle-aged me is fiercely protective of her now in a way that no one was back then. So I can't go back and, you know, 50 years in time and protect her, but I can in other ways now. And that helps with some of the grief.
Beautiful. Was there anything specific that you wanted to talk about that we didn't discuss?
Oh gosh, I think we covered pretty much a lot of the book. So no, that
I love this. This was really interesting for me. So obviously people can find the books, and then how can people work with you?
So the book, The Obligation Myth, Rethinking Like You Owe Your Difficult Aging Parent. Right now it's only on Amazon because I'm in the KDP Select, but it'll be everywhere come August. I do have a Substack. If you go to Lisa D. Stinson, PhD on Substack, you can find my community there. Okay. I started it up just 6 weeks ago, and it's just an amazing group of people. So that's happening. And I do post long form content every week, as well as daily notes and just different bits on dysfunctional families, narcissistic abuse, from a partner, from parents. This week's long form post was actually on, you know, the workplace bully and why the workplace bully targets you, also based in kind of, are you invisible? Are you a scapegoat? Yeah. So that's kind of the Substack there. And in terms of working with me, so I do live outside of the United States now, and that makes licensing laws for doing any kind of psychotherapy an impossibility. Licensing won't travel internationally, and the French bureaucracy makes it too difficult for me to work in practice here. So what I do have is something set up through my Substack and the founding member tier. I'll offer a one-time 90-minute consultation. If there's a particular issue that you want to address, we can process through that. So there's an intake form that I email out, and then we'll do our session, and then I'll follow up with a case conceptualization and some homework, kind of recommended things to work on. And also through the Substack, I'm going to start in August doing a monthly Q&A, so people can send their questions in, and then we'll do live Q&A that way as well. So those will be a couple of options where people can reach me directly. Otherwise, writing's on the Substack and through my book.
Awesome. Well, we will put links to everything. So I really appreciate this. And I'd love to have you back on to talk about other things. What you holding on? So you've been in therapy for years. Maybe you've been in 12-step recovery for years. You've read the books, you know your attachment style, you understand your trauma, and yet you're still waiting to actually feel different. You're still stuck in the same patterns you've been stuck in for a really, really long time. And listen, if I am describing you here, no shame at all, because for a very, very long time, this was me. And then I realized that all of my healing had been from the neck up. I had never actually gotten into my body, and I learned that
somatic healing, nervous system regulation, it's not optional. Like, it's not just a suggestion. It is a requirement if you actually want to heal from a dysfunctional childhood. And what do you know? Once I actually started doing that work, I finally started making headway on the patterns that I was starting to think that I was going to be stuck in for the rest of my life. And so I built a course, y'all. It is called Safe Within, and it is everything that has actually worked for me all in one 7-week live journey. It's 3 parts. In the first part, we are going to actually learn how to feel safe in our bodies through practices rooted in somatic experiencing and polyvagal theory. Then in part 2, through somatic parts work, we are going to get to know the parts of us that are keeping us stuck in places that we don't want to be stuck in. And then in part 3, this is about actually learning how to feel good as a felt experience in your body. Because let's be honest, for so many of us, good feelings are deeply uncomfortable. Calm feels unsafe, joy feels suspicious, and we're going to do something about that, okay? And here's something I want to be really honest about. One of the biggest reasons I struggled to do this work for so long is that I could not get myself to do it alone. Like, every day I would tell myself, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And then what do you know, at the end of the day, I had not done X, Y, and Z. This was day after day after day, year after year after year. And so part of what I built into this intentionally is the accountability piece. We meet live, you show up. You can't just talk yourself out of it the way that you can when you're trying to do this stuff on your own. And listen, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that you're going to be perfectly healed after 7 weeks. But what I do think is that you are going to feel a hell of a lot more connected to your body. You are going to feel much safer actually being in your body. And you're going to walk away with tools that you will use for years, if not for the rest of your damn life. And I want to make this very, very clear. You do not need to have any prior experience with IFS, with parts work, somatic work to do this course. None. You can show up having never heard of any of these words before, and you will be taken care of. I will guide you through every single step. So we start July 1st. When you sign up, you also get 2 months free in the shit show with access to all of our weekly support groups and everything else that we got going on in there. So you, yes, you, yes, you, the person who knows that they need to sign up, the person who is currently in their head right now, thinking about how I need to do this course, get out of your damn head and get into your damn body. Take that little hand of yours, get on your computer or on your phone, and just sign the hell up already. Go to adultchildpodcast.com/safewithin, adultchildpodcast.com/safewithin. And if you have any questions at all, feel free to email me directly at Andrea@adultchildpodcast.com. Do it. Do it now.